You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Suspicious Minds by Kathleen Hale. As a scholar, Ramsland approaches true crime through a clinical lens, distinguishing her interest in the genre from its entertainment value. Like many of the women at CrimeCon, whose long list of safety precautions had partly been gleaned, they said, from crime stories, carrying mace, walking in groups, calling a friend to say where you're going, the subtext being that if you're abducted, people will know sooner, raising the statistical likelihood of finding you, or at least your corpse, Ramsland's conclusions on personal safety underscore the universal danger of being female. When I walk past a male on the street, I will always watch over my shoulder, always, Ramsland said to me in a follow-up interview, explaining that if somebody were to roll down their window and ask for directions, she would never approach the car. Because I've known some of the strategies that offenders use to grab vulnerable people, which is not to say they could never get one over on me. Of course they could, she added. Still, Ramsland said she did what she could to avoid being killed by men like those she studied. I have yet to take a ride share. I caught up with Natalia and Stacy later that evening at a bar off the Marriott lobby. The two were enjoying a long-awaited glass of wine. Earlier that day, to Stacy's irritation, Natalia had forgotten to bring along their water bottles, filled to the brim with Pinot Grigio, a misunderstanding they'd since settled. We love each other to the moon and back, Natalia said, flashing her moonstone ring, a gift from Stacy. Stacy recounted how, as a kid, she used to drill pins for her dad outside the family's construction company in a field surrounded by men. When her dad noticed his male employees staring at her budding breast, he moved her to the front office, assigning her solitary administrative work instead. Pay attention to what's going on around you, he warned. I thought I was being punished, Stacy admitted. Yet she recalled with apparent fondness how the same men who had ogled her as a child suddenly became protective of her when other men did the same. She was describing the patriarchy's split personality, which simultaneously sexualizes and infantilizes women. The latter approach, when weighed against the alternative, being killed, begins to feel surprisingly comforting. It does kind of suck, she admitted. Like, yeah, maybe I didn't get strangled, but why do we have to wake up and think about that? Like Stacy, Natalia worked in a male-dominated industry. Mixing in those circles had made her a little bit of a dick, she admitted, just to prevent men from taking advantage, a phenomenon, her tone implied, with which she had ample experience. I have understood your tribe. I hear your jokes. I smell your farts, she said of men, whom Natalia had learned to live without, choosing instead to snuggle with her pet turtles, Sexy Rexy and Ninja Turtle, which Stacy later cited jokingly as one reason that she and Natalia had not simply married one another. Just then, Stacy's husband, Emmett, who was sitting at the bar, glued to a college football game, shouted at the TV, drunk and happy, "Shit, he's running!" Stacy recalled a joke she'd recently made to him. "And this is a terrible thing to say," she said. "But I joked one day." Oh, her voice turned sad, tinged with theatrical realization. "I'm not rapable anymore." It was something she remembered hearing on a show where a woman was running through a parking lot and someone said, "You should be careful." "Don't worry," the character responded, "I'm too old for anyone to rape me," a sentence that, to Stacy, perfectly distilled what is arguably the most effed-up layer of womanhood. After a certain age, The constant threat of rape fades, leaving in its wake a deafening silence. And pathetically, it's only then, once the constant catcalling and threats of violence wane, that the truly pathological part sets in. Suddenly deprived of all the little indignities that have soundtracked our lives, we miss them. The patriarchy leaves an indelible mark on us, and we hate it for that, even as we still crave its attention. It gets harder and harder being a woman, Natalia agreed. And then they turned to me, demanding to know why I seemed so interested in their pain and whether I had any of my own. Of course I related to them. The first time a stranger slapped my ass, I was 12 years old. Over the intervening years, strange men pulled me onto their laps, called me a bitch, and stood in my way when I wanted to leave, among countless other formative experiences, including more overt forms of sexual violence that I don't care to list here, because I'd rather lose myself in other people's stories than relive my own. At this point, Emmett sank into the booth, wanting me to know that so far he had not enjoyed Crime Con. Pedophiles, rape, it's not for me, he said, sounding proud of himself. It's interesting, Stacy began carefully, hypothesizing that perhaps part of the reason she and Natalia gravitated toward crime stories was not necessarily because they loved rape and murder and pedophilia, but because being a woman leads to trauma, and exposing oneself to other people's traumas helps to make sense of one's own experiences, to contextualize them, and to find community. For women, I think, especially when it comes to rape or sexual assault, I think we already kind of know about it, she ventured, instinctively adding a question mark to the end of her sentence to soften its blow, just like Tammy of Shammy had done. Emmett interrupted her, wait, 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 hold on, but said nothing else. I think that's why there might be way more women here than men, I offered. Yeah, I saw the line to the restroom, he joked back. By 5 p.m. that evening, crowds that had gathered 8 hours earlier showed no signs of thinning. One woman zoomed past me on her surgery scooter, pushing herself along with one good foot, unstoppable in her quest for more crime stories. Inside the grand ballroom, a huge audience awaited a presentation by the tenacious former prosecutor turned crime commentator, Nancy Grace. Mad as hell, and we're not going to take it anymore. Like so many women at Crime Con, Grace was driven into this space by unthinkable trauma. When she was 19 years old, Grace's fiancé was murdered just before their wedding, a tragedy that catapulted Grace into a long, successful tenure as a special prosecutor in Atlanta, then known as the murder capital of America, after which came jobs at Court TV's Closing Arguments, 1997 to 2007, followed by other shows like Nancy Grace, 2005 to 2016, and years punctuated by a slew of books, TV appearances, public speeches, and a podcast. Grace's Crime Con presentations in particular are something to behold. Speeches doesn't quite capture the drama of her stagecraft, which feels more akin to performance art, good performance art, about a woman who effing hates crime. At each recitation, Grace weeps fresh tears into the microphone, reliving her fiancé's murder, bullet wound by bullet wound, his back, his neck, his face, with those beautiful blue eyes, conducting her grief into furious dissections of contemporary criminal cases, followed by adulations of joy over her many blessings. The process involves lots of yelling from Grace, known in part for her brash southern drawl, bellowing sometimes in anger. They saw their mommy's head blow up like a pumpkin, but also sometimes in joy. One of the happiest moments of my day is when I take the twins to school. Her eyes flash, her nose runs, the fringe on her leather blazer trembles with every emotional turn. The night before, Molly and Kirsten had warned me of Grace's intensity. The most memorable experience of Crime Con last year for me was the unhinged quality of Nancy Grace's session, applauded Kirsten. She was out of her mind. Molly recalled how Grace had railed against illegal immigrants, prompting the women in her audience to rejoice, "God bless you, Nancy." "It felt like I was at some weird Republican convention," Kirsten said. And Molly launched into an alarmingly accurate impersonation of Grace's accent, all sliding vowels and loud consonants, exclaiming, "Good Southern gentleman, good Southern girl, good Southern young man." "When I observed that Grace might not be up on her gender studies," Molly quipped, "she's not up on anything." "But she is up on volume studies," wisecracked Kirsten, referring to Grace's voice and voluminous bleached blonde hair. While Kirsten considered Grace's messaging to be problematic, bordering on dangerous, she nevertheless conceded her support as a fellow woman. "I love that you're a lady and you're successful. I'm glad. I'm happy," she said of Grace. "The point is, she's just wild in the mind," Kirsten explained. But for Nancy Grace superfans, the unhinged quality of her talks is exactly what makes them so powerful. Grace subscribes to old-school Christian standards of femininity. She cooks for her family 5 nights a week, prays over every meal, and painstakingly compiles at least 3 scrapbooks per year to commemorate Christmas, summer vacation, and the twins' birthday. Born 2 months premature when Grace was 48, a miracle that never ceases to amaze her. "After our interview," she urged me, "get back to your babies." Her burning hatred for crime is easily mistaken for tough-on-crime politics, a dangerous movement that has ruined our juvenile justice system, drained taxes, disproportionately affected people of color, and, studies have shown, raised recidivism rates. But Grace is not a politician. She rallies for no cause other than emotional ventilation. At her CrimeCon book signing, where an endless queue of women clutched copies of Grace's book, Don't Be a Victim, I met several survivors, including Ashley and her wife, Kimberly, together 17 years. Kimberly had helped Ashley overcome the psychological scarring of child abuse. As lesbians, they were unbothered by Grace's right-leaning politics, because what mattered to them more was that she screamed herself hoarse on behalf of victims. Just as she once had in Atlanta, back when a male attorney called Grace an embarrassment to female prosecutors because she dared advocate for murdered women from a place of emotion. Ashley compared her to Olivia Benson, the fictional heroine on Law & Order SVU. As a child, Ashley had fantasized that Benson might save her. Today, Grace preaches to a different sort of jury, telling brutal true stories about dead women to massive audiences of women who, statistically, have likely been victimized themselves. And in that sense, although Grace might take issue with this characterization, given the loathsome politicization of the term, she is a feminist. In a way, she embodies CrimeCon's feminine id, the unfiltered voice of 4,000 women's collective rage and sorrow. As the unending line of Grace acolytes inched closer to their patron saint of trauma, a crying woman, Dornette Mullings, stepped from the front. She had flown to Orlando with a stack of flyers bearing the face of her twin, Calvin. According to Mullings, he died under suspicious circumstances that the local police seemed intent to ignore. Grace sat quietly at her folding table, listening to Mullings' story, that Dornette had traveled to CrimeCon to beg Grace to cover Calvin's case on her podcast, tugged at Grace's heartstrings, that the two had been twins brought Grace to tears. "We will do it," she assured Mullings, promising to highlight Calvin's story. "We will do it immediately." Mullings sobbed with sheer relief. Later, she texted that CrimeCon had been the therapy I needed. "In 2 days, I got so much support from people who understood my emotions and my thoughts," Mullings texted. "Even though the focus was on crime, there was an opportunity for grieving and healing for me. On the final day of CrimeCon, I visited Expo Hall. True crime-related booths filled the space. Some repped podcast, hawking free stickers, while others were manned by small businesses. marketing items ranging from dolls to self-defense weapons, disguised as women's handbags, hairspray canisters, and lipstick. Nearby stood a female mannequin wearing a gown of crime scene tape, her black and yellow skirt fluttering gently in the breeze from an air conditioning unit. Outside the grand ballroom, I bid goodbye to Molly and Kirsten. They'd spent just enough time at CrimeCon to get all the autographs they wanted, and next on their honeymoon was Tampa, followed by an Airbnb on the Gulf, where they hoped to see some manatees, Kirsten's favorite animal. As attendees wheeled suitcases past emptying event spaces, I found Stacy and Natalia at the Marriott bar, immersed in casual conversation with a fellow crime junkie and her dog photos. "We're conducting our own interview," Stacy joked, gesturing to the stranger, Ashley, who incidentally owned 7 dogs and was currently at odds with the bartender over service of more mimosas. After coaxing him into pouring a beer, Ashley shared with us that she had escaped an abusive relationship at age 19, shortly after having her first child. As a survivor, she felt activated by true stories of domestic violence. Gabby Petito's infamous traffic stop in particular had enraged her, especially when people insinuated online that Gabby should have been tougher or more vocal with police, who had handled the entire situation atrociously. In fact, being tougher or strong-headed, as Ashley describes her younger self, just makes it the abuse worse. According to research, standing up to one's oppressor can prove deadly to a woman suffering intimate partner violence. The most dangerous moment is when a woman tries to leave. Alternatively, a lack of support from law enforcement can also foster a kill or be killed mindset, driving some victims to murder their abusers. Because that's what happens if you are a tough woman, Natalia commiserated. You're probably going to end up being the one in trouble the rest of your life. During her own abusive marriage, one of Natalia's biggest anxieties had been the possibility of accidentally killing her husband in self-defense, hence her fascination with Snapped, a true crime series that profiles women accused or convicted of murder, focusing on the violence that made them snap. "Not that I would do it," she emphasized, yet she related to the despair of seeing no other way out. Natalia had wed at the tender age of 20, after courting a close friend under the watchful eye of a chaperone. "Everything was by the Bible," she said, describing the community of Jehovah's Witnesses in which she'd been raised. "Once we married, everything changed. He was a completely different person." Natalia says she appealed to church elders, who warned that leaving her husband would result in excommunication. She did it anyway. After the divorce, Natalia lost everything, her friends, her family, her spirituality, and completely started over on her own. Then she met Stacy, who had been raised Mormon. They related to each other's experience of being black sheep in high-demand religions. And there were darker shared experiences, too. Outside the church, they had both suffered abuse at the hands of men. Clearly rattled by the memory, Stacy said to me, "I don't think I want to go back to that room." Chiding herself, she added, "I didn't even mean to talk about it." When asked what feelings arose when she tried to talk about it, Stacy hesitated before answering on behalf of herself, Natalia, Ashley, and perhaps all women embroiled in intimate partner violence. "I think the unfortunate thing is that we feel shame. We feel like somehow we had something to do with it." Even now, she was hardest on herself, contemplating, "What could I have done better? How did I put myself in that position?" "And also, how they talked to you later after the fact," Stacy added. "Because then, after the abuse," he says, "it didn't happen the way that you thought it happened, and then you question yourself and what you really saw or felt. It's just a spiral." She trailed off, unwilling to go further, explaining that even remembering the abuse made her red. Nobody understood that fire like Natalia, with whom Stacy had so much in common. Shortly after their meeting, Stacy recalled finding herself alone in a parking garage when all at once the enormity of that face-reddening abuse washed over her and she felt her knees buckle. The next thing she knew, she was sitting on the cold concrete floor with her back against the tire of somebody else's car, crying uncontrollably. And despite not really knowing her that well, Stacy instinctively phoned Natalia, who showed up in what felt like 0 seconds, and held Stacy in her arms for an eternity. And then, sometime later, they binged the entire Casey Anthony trial, and everything started to feel better somehow. It was a friendship forged in violence, empathy, and healing, one that carried them to CrimeCon, where the last recorded song to play over the intercom before Creighton Waters' band took the stage had been I Will Survive. Before leaving for the airport, I wandered the CrimeCon gift shop, passing up branded travel mugs and cheeky crop tops, I'm only here for an alibi, for a tote stamped with I Know Things in groovy pink lettering. For whatever reason, the bag called to me, but I ended up putting it back, too much of a conversation starter. Strange men no longer tried to rape me, but they still got in my way, subjecting me to lectures and other unwanted advances, unimaginable to any man. Just that weekend, an Uber driver tried to buckle my seatbelt. A male Marriott staffer forced me to guess, 3 times, the cost of my ramen noodles before agreeing to sell them to me at a discount, pressuring me to thank him. The next man I encountered cornered me at 1 a.m. to preach about his love of Marriott Bonvoy travel points before asking me whether I had children. I did not wish to increase the likelihood of such encounters by wearing I Know Things over one shoulder, inevitably prompting someone bearded to smirk, "So, what things do you know?" At which point I would need to respond, and who knew how long the stupid back and forth would last. All to preserve his fragile ego, because regardless of a woman's age, you just never know who's going to kill you. But I'm alive, and I am lucky. As I write this, countless people, some of them only children, are being subjected to sex trafficking and enslavement, among other horrors. 89,000 women and girls were murdered around the globe in 2022, one of the most violent years on record. People like the Afghan activist I recently met, who told me she can never return home or the Taliban will kill her. Or Keshay Jacobs, who went missing 7 years ago, prompting her mother, Tony, to attend last year's CrimeCon to raise awareness. Tony learned a few weeks before this story was published that Keshay was murdered. The vast majority of these stories are never heard. Later, I thought of the women of CrimeCon as I boarded my flight home. I was planning to write this story on the plane, but as I took my seat, my brain blitzed, short-circuited by all those traumas. And so, to clear my head, I did what many women do. I switched on a violent crime show about a victim I'd never met. She'd been abducted to replace another woman who had herself been abducted to replace the one before her, and so on, like Russian dolls, each one killed and tossed aside like garbage when she could not satisfy their captor's sick fantasies, until finally the newest woman in the chain murdered their jailer on every woman's behalf, breaking the cycle. And it relaxed me to go into this dark place where all my troubles felt light in comparison. My mind could finally start working.
Thank you.
Red Queen in Exile, Ladoon, the $89 million Hamptons property where controversial art publisher Louise Bluin entertained everyone from Prince Andrew to Calvin Klein, is about to welcome new owners after a bankruptcy sale. But Bluin is not leaving quietly, and she's not bankrupt either, she tells Vanity Fair, by Jennifer Gould. Opening photo, Estate of Mind, sitting on 4 acres, comprising 2 homes and ocean access, Ladoon, which has been on and off the market since 2016, backdrops Louise Bluin's lavish parties and financial woes. And Bluin at the Impact Wealth magazine party in 2023. Grab a coffee at the Golden Pear in Southampton, New York. Drive due south almost a mile straight down Main Street. Take a left onto Gin Lane. It's just a 5-minute drive. As your GPS will tell you, you've arrived. The storied street, one of the most exclusive in the Hamptons, runs parallel to the ocean. It's filled with grand old shingled homes, some built in the late 1880s, hidden from view behind hedgerows of privet, a hardy shrub first brought to the Hamptons by English settlers in the 1600s. From your turn onto Gin Lane, it's another 0.7 miles to number 376. Here sits a cedar shingled house, which you can't see from the street, built in 1888 on the Rosa Rugosa Dunes for railroad tycoon Robert Oliphant, the great-great-great-grandfather of actor Timothy Oliphant. The house is rumored, but never proven, to have been designed by Stanford White, the Gilded Age starchitect and accused sexual predator. White was 47 when he allegedly raped 16-year-old Evelyn Nesbitt, and 52 when Nesbitt's then-husband, multimillionaire Harry Kendall Thaw, shot him dead. The house, first known as Eden Cottage, has direct access to the beach. Film buffs may recognize it from Woody Allen's 1978 movie Interiors. Its own feature, coffered ceilings, 9 fireplaces, and French doors galore. In 1990, Carl Spielvogel, the late ad mogul, and Barbara Lee Diamonstein Spielvogel, the landmarks expert, bought the 12-bedroom house. The Spielvogels hired White's great-grandson, architect Sam White, to restore the home, which they called Bonnie Dune, the home's name since the turn of the century. Then they decided they needed a bigger place. Enter Louise Bluin and John McBain. The couple bought the estate for a reported $13.5 million in late 1997 and renamed it Ladoon. The house had just been through a storm. Perhaps it was an omen, but a steel bulkhead had been installed and the sale went through. There was no bulkhead, however, to protect the McBains' marriage from the elements, which in the Hamptons includes a certain type of striving that can be as destructive as it is all-consuming. As the McBain family settled in, they built a second house on the Hamptons property with interiors by the late François Catrou, a decorator to aristocrats, Russian oligarchs, and rich Americans. The guest house features 9 bedrooms, 8 baths, 2 powder rooms, a home theater, and a billiard room. Both homes boast gyms, saunas, and staff quarters. The compound sits on 4.2 prime oceanfront acres, with 19 bedrooms between them, 2 pools, and a sunken all-weather tennis court. Blonde, beautiful, and wildly ambitious, Bluin had made a fortune with McBain, creating an international classified ad empire. Ladoon was the perfect place to show off their success. But the couple, who brought their own strengths to the business, were growing apart. By 2000, they had divorced. Bluin began to travel the jet-setting art world circuit with auctioneer Simon Dupuy, chairman of Philips Dupuy in Luxembourg, who had become her boyfriend following the breakup of her marriage. DePuree hired her to be CEO. By 2003, her relationship with DePuree and his company had come to an end, and she moved into art publishing. As she moved into the art world, Blue Ann launched a foundation, held Art Davos-style global creative leadership summits, and handed out awards to world leaders Bill Clinton, billionaires Carlos Slim, Nobel Prize winners Elie Wiesel, some neuroscientist, and famous artist Jeff Koons. She threw parties for her foundation at places like the Venice Biennale with her then-boyfriend Prince Andrew in tow. Her big ideas explored creativity in the brain and using culture to promote world peace. Only her ego was bigger. She put her name in front of all her publications and websites. Blue Ann had an eye for talent, but a manic nature, bombarding her staff with nonsensical staccato emails. She was fun, she was creative, but no one on her team took her seriously, says a former publicist. And while Blue Ann would generously fly some staff on private jets for ski trips and invite others to work retreats at Ladoon, allegations swirled that she cut people's pay, fired them, or stiffed them altogether. In interviews with Vanity Fair, ex-staff call her a liar, a sociopath, and vindictive. A kinder word would be delusions of grandeur, said one former executive. Blue Ann's companies have also been sued by a landlord, a printer, and many others, according to reports and staffers interviewed by Vanity Fair. The New York Post dubbed her the Red Queen for her penchant for wearing the color and for her Alice in Wonderland off-with-their-heads management style. She thought she was a genius, but she just wasn't, says one former senior staffer. She presented herself as this brilliant businesswoman, a thinker, and a kind of tech visionary, like some kind of global figure in a Steve Jobs way. And now Blue Ann has finally lost Ladoon. The estate was sold in a bankruptcy sale this winter. What has happened since then is not totally dissimilar from other stumbles and scandals in Blue Ann's long public history. She is crying foul and unfair play, mulling her options to sue everyone from her brokers to the auction house that sold Ladoon, even the New York Times, for an interview she gave after the sale. Ms. Blue Ann contacted us to raise what she believed to be inaccuracies, says a spokesperson for the New York Times. We carefully reviewed those concerns and concluded the story was accurate as published. We stand by the reporting. The first time I spoke to Blue Ann, it was by phone on her final night at Ladoon. It had been more than a quarter of a century since she had first bought the Gin Lane estate. Her voice was calm, even, unemotional, and slightly regal, like Judy Dench's fictional spy chief, M, in the James Bond films. That was the first of two long interviews. What followed was a flurry of emails, text, and phone calls. I stopped counting after 50. At one point, she sent me a digitally constructed evidence board, like the kind you see in the movies, featuring pictures of and red arrows around the people whom she claims have conspired against her. It would be incomprehensible to even try to detail it here. To sum it up, she has a lot to say. For one thing, she insists, she does have empathy, and that's why she went into the arts and took care of her mother when she had Alzheimer's disease and her husband following a ski accident in 2015. She also says she is only just now unraveling a massive fraud orchestrated by key members of her publishing team to the tune of millions. When she found out, she says, she shut down and transferred the New York office overseas. The last time Blue Ann spoke with Vanity Fair for this story, she wanted to underscore points she'd emailed, texted, and called about. I don't pay things. When you're a chairman and CEO of a global company, you don't pay things, she said via Zoom. And then a few breaths later, I paid everyone. They stole the money on the other side. Some ex-staff interviewed by Vanity Fair also believe there were some irregularities, but not on the scale that Blue Ann alleges. Others say their work practices were standard. Bluann claims the Manhattan District Attorney opened an investigation. The DA declined to comment. As for the house, she has seller's remorse, said John Allerding, a lawyer for Bay Point Advisors, Bluann's last lender. If there had been a minimum reserve bid, we would have had no bidders, and we would be in the same position as we were when we got involved in September 2022. Two properties that nobody wanted, generating expenses. The Department of Justice has an ongoing investigation involving federal withholdings from Bluann's employees' paychecks that were never sent to the government. Bluann has lodged her own complaint against the government. When reached by Vanity Fair, an IRS investigator and the IRS spokesperson declined to comment. From Europe, Bluann tells Vanity Fair the company allocated money to pay the withholding, but that it never made it to the federal government. She says she had nothing to do with any fraud because she didn't run her company and that she welcomes the IRS investigation. The truth will finally come out, she says. The Big Apple ate me, Bluann says in another call with a laugh. I wasn't lucky in New York. The house on Gin Lane is far from Dorval, the Montreal suburb where Bluann grew up in comfort, one of six children. Her parents ran an insurance brokerage. She went to private schools and sailed competitively. According to the Toronto Star, she traces her heritage on her mother's side to Jacques Vigier, the first mayor of Montreal, elected in 1833. Bluann attended McGill University but never graduated. She annulled her first marriage to David Stewart, an RJR McDonald tobacco heir. In 1987, Bluann married McBain. A Rhodes Scholar and son of a Liberal member of Parliament, McBain was a rising star at Power Corporation, which was owned by the family of Bluann's brother-in-law, Paul Desmarais Jr., who came from one of Canada's wealthiest families. As the McBain's business grew, the couple moved to Europe and summered at Ladoon, where they enjoyed family life with their three children and threw lavish parties. But McBain did not share Bluann's social ambitions, some say, and the couple grew apart. 2 years after buying Ladoon in 2000, the marriage was over, but the parties continued. Calvin Klein, Ross Bleckner, and Bianca Jagger were among the many guests. Bluann sold her share of the business to her ex-husband for a reported $200 million. The men she dated during this new chapter, including Simon Depure, the Mick Jagger of auctioneers, and Prince Andrew, were also drawn to Ladoon. For many years, Ladoon was Bluann's calling card, luring stars and their hangers-on through the oceanfront doors. But over time, it became an albatross. By 2018, a $26 million mortgage required additional lenders. In 2023, the compound was both in bankruptcy protection and on the market for an astonishing $150 million. It was also for rent for millions of dollars. If she could have gotten a renter at $2 million or $3 million for the summer, which was possible, she would have been able to service the loan, a broker who once worked with Bluann told Vanity Fair. Those who walked through the compound during its final months on the market told Vanity Fair that it had great bones, but there was something tragic about it. One banker, who attended a lunch prepared by Bluann's private chef on a terrace overlooking the ocean last summer, ultimately turned down her refinancing request. When people live above their means, against assets they have or inherited in order to tread water, it typically doesn't end well. Nobody thought it was worth $150 million. It felt like gray gardens, with faded Hiroshi Sugimoto seascape photographs on the wall, he says. Such grand old houses, he notes, get really beaten down by the ocean. Ultimately, on a cold winter night in January, Bluann lost Ladoon in a live foreclosure auction that lasted a little longer than 5 hours at Sotheby's New York offices on the Upper East Side. The sale was the first time Sotheby's auctioned real estate live alongside art in a collection titled Visions of America. This should be a series on Netflix, a would-be buyer whispered, referring to all the drama. I'm surprised she kept the house as long as she did, a former Ladun worker had told me. John, her ex-husband, was easy to deal with, but she didn't spend enough on the home's upkeep. She reminded me of Nick Nolte in Down and Out in Beverly Hills. The compound ultimately sold for $88.48 million, including broker commissions. It sounds like a lot, but the amount was far less than the debt on the property, according to Bay Point advisors. Blue Ann voiced her objections to the sale, without legal representation in a central islip bankruptcy court in February. She is currently contesting how funds from Ladun's sale should be allocated. Court-ordered mediation with Bay Point was set for the summer. If unsuccessful, both sides will be back in court by late July after this story is published. She also disputes whether she owes Bay Point. Blue Ann has long since shut down her art publishing empire, although she says she is building an online archive. She has also sold much of her trophy real estate, including a penthouse duplex at 165 Charles Street, designed by her friend Richard Meyer. Two women who worked for Blue Ann and sued Louise Blue Ann Media Incorporated and its owner Louise Blue Ann for money owed say they are still waiting to be paid in full, despite a settlement agreement. Nevertheless, Blue Ann's fighting spirit and apparently her lifestyle remains. Everyone crafts their own story. In Blue Ann's narrative, she is one of the world's most successful self-made businesswomen, an internet visionary, and a woman of big ideas for the better of all. By last winter, she was described in a Bay Point prospectus this way. The origin of Blue Ann's wealth arose through the co-creation of Trader.com, which performed a joint IPO on the NASDAQ and Paris Bourse in 2000, achieving a valuation of approximately $2.7 billion. Blue Ann held 22% of the shares. But she also sees herself as a victim. As Blue Ann tells it, this whole experience has been quite enough. For one, she says, there was that woman who introduced her to a fake buyer, a Dallas real estate developer who was actually indicted for allegedly scamming Chinese investors out of $26 million, who had snuck into Ladun during COVID and squatted in Blue Ann's own bedroom for months. Imagine, in a house with all those bedrooms. Why did she have to choose mine? She wanted to be me. And the lenders, forget about it. They go in and torture you, and they have been threatening, she says, like gangsters. This is what she's always done, says one of Blue Ann's former senior execs. She says, I'm the CEO, I own the company, and I had nothing to do with anything going on in my company. That's hard to believe. It's like Donald Trump saying he didn't know about payments to Stormy Daniels. It's the same MO, not taking responsibility and blaming someone else. Like Trump, Blue Ann has never filed for personal bankruptcy. I'm not bankrupt. That's nonsense, she says. I've been attacked by predatory behavior. I had classic mortgages for many years. This was one real estate transaction out of so many. It's important to put it in perspective. We all make mistakes. Next photo, seeing red, auctioneer Simon DePierre and Blue Ann at the 2001 dinner Phillips exhibition at Collection Bergeron in Paris. And in the photo, she's wearing a red dress. A few weeks after we first spoke, I met Blue Ann in Paris, where she lives when she's not in Switzerland, her primary residence. She had recently returned from a ski holiday. We rendezvoused at Hôtel de l'Abbaye, a vine-covered house in Paris near the Luxembourg Gardens, within walking distance from Blue Ann's home. Blue Ann arrived on time, all in black, a hairband keeping her perfectly blonde hair off her face. Her look was barefaced, revealing the confidence of a woman who looks at least a decade younger than her 65 years. She speaks Parisian French, with not a trace of her native Quebecois. At first, Blue Ann was reluctant to talk, But once she started, it seemed hard for her to stop. While she was happy to discuss the brain, creativity, AI, and geopolitics, she was reluctant to discuss her social circles, which once reportedly included Prince and Princess Michael of Kent and Prince Andrew. Back then, Prince Andrew was the UK's special representative for international trade and investment, and matched nicely with Blue Anne's vision of global diplomacy through culture and trade and money. According to the Daily Mail, around 2004, he was a nocturnal visitor to Blue Anne's Holland Park home in London, and she began introducing him as her boyfriend. Friends warned Blue Anne that Prince Andrew was a playboy, but she didn't listen. Preparing for his visit to Ladoon, she uprooted trees and planted new ones trimmed to the same height to line the driveway, according to reports. Once there, the prince enjoyed private Pilates instruction and massage. He watched The Lord of the Rings in her private screening room, and they'd end the days with dinner and walks on the beach. But it didn't last. Their next rendezvous was months later, an unannounced visit to her Holland Park home, the Daily Mail noted. Then, say those reports, he ghosted her. At the mention of the tainted prince's name, Blue Anne shrugs. "No, nothing," Blue Anne says, "when I ask if there were any signs of creepiness, given his association with Jeffrey Epstein. He was fun, he's nice, and he was always a total gentleman." Blue Anne says she never met Epstein or his jailed companion, Ghislaine Maxwell, but Andrew certainly didn't help himself with that terrible interview on the BBC, she adds. For Blue Anne's adult life, mixing work and romance has come naturally. She made her fortune creating trader classified media with McBain. They started with a publication for car classified ads in Quebec and ended up with hundreds around the world, in print and online, from France, Germany, and Italy to Russia, China, Canada, and Australia. Then, while romantically involved with Depuret, Blue Anne became CEO of his auction house, Philips Depuret in Luxembourg. LVMH's Bernard Arnault had wanted to turn Philips into a global player, but he backed out after 9/11. It was a hard time to be in the luxury business. Blue Anne clashed with Depuret's business partner and former Sotheby's colleague Daniela Luxembourg, a talented Israeli art dealer. As Blue Anne realized Depuret would always side with Luxembourg, and it became evident that Blue Anne was never going to invest in Philips, the courtship came to an end. Blue Anne resigned after 10 months on the job. "I came to Philips to help them restructure because they had lost $100 million. And I did that," Blue Anne says now. "I never wanted to invest. The auction business seems glamorous, but it is very tough. From the outside, it's so sexy, all the nice jewelry and design, but it's chaos. You're getting content from someone who died or gets divorced. Every day you have to restart. There are very few repeats. And it isn't regulated. The auction business," she says, "is all about your contacts, and that's what I hate about it. I hate asking anything from anyone. I just came in and cleaned up. I wouldn't invest. Simon was so disappointed. I left him because of money. That I can share." Some men don't kiss and tell. Depuret does. He wrote about Blue Anne in his 2016 book with William Stadium, The Auctioneer: Adventures in the Art Trade. "I next was involved with Louise Blue Anne McBain," Depuret wrote, "a female tycoon by whose entrepreneurial gifts I had been smitten. Her power and success, not to mention the Marie Antoinette splendor of her lifestyle, was aphrodisiacal. Blue Anne tells me the book was awful. Depuret did not return Vanity Fair's request for comment." "When I ask what she learned from that relationship," Blue Anne says, "not enough. I should have learned to be more careful about people who always want my money." Instead of getting out of the art world following the breakup, Blue Anne dove deeper. Louise Blue Anne Media began to buy up art publications, starting with Art and Auction in March 2003. Modern Painters followed. Then she created Art Info, which famously imploded. Freelancers who claimed they were owed money even formed a group. Wonka, writers angry at Art Info, not kidding around anymore. Yet no one was doing anything like this, says Andrew Goldstein, a former executive editor of Art Info. It was a moment when art was starting to get into the culture more. So we took a different tack, not so academic and pious, and that became very successful very rapidly. But then one day, Louise walked in and said she wanted the name changed to Blue Ann Art Info, says Kate Shanley, the former publisher of Art and Auction. Overnight, the URL changed. We lost all our traffic. We couldn't deliver campaigns, and everybody was screwed. Her name went in front of everything, and it totally screwed up the revenue. It was a very egomaniacal move, and just impulsive. She had creative ideas, but she had no sense of how to make them work. It's almost like she could have had a really great empire, but she screwed it up. To Vanity Fair, Blue Ann maintains 5 or 6 ex-staffers committed fraud, created fake contracts, pocketing money, company money, taking unapproved luxury trips to places like St. Bart's, and making side deals with advertisers. When an employee vanished and allegedly took all her computers to South America, she says, in May, Blue Ann told Vanity Fair the fraud and lost income was estimated at $10 million. By the end of May, that number was $18 million. We are still unraveling it, says Blue Ann. I told the IRS I wasn't involved personally, and I never ran the company. One senior manager tells Vanity Fair that staff were paid by checks signed by Blue Ann. To suggest her finance staff were engaged in fraud beggars belief, he says. Louise controlled the finances. She decided what got paid, from salaries to expenses. She is narcissistic and will blame everyone else, not take responsibility, and exaggerate certain things with this fraud stuff, says a former senior executive, tasked by Blue Ann to find evidence of fraud. Some is fraud, some isn't. She'll say all of it is. However, another former senior executive says that on a trip to Ukraine, Blue Ann discovered that she was paying for a larger operation than what actually existed. Blue Ann, who never graduated from college, set up the Louise T. Blue Ann Foundation with the stated purpose of exploring the brain's connection to creativity, inspired by her own dyslexia. The Blue Ann Foundation still exists, Blue Ann says. She hopes to hold the next summit in November, around the time she says she will release her memoir, Obsession. If people understood the arts better, they'd understand culture and foreign policy better, Blue Ann tells me. There's a lot of money to be made in the space between art and finance. Louise made nothing, an ex-staffer had told me. It's almost heartbreaking, or tragic, how she lost everything, even her real estate. It's like she drank her own Kool-Aid. The most important thing is to capture my business, not my social life, Blue Ann tells me. My work is my passion. When I had 20 million ads, that was my major success and career. The arts was, is, philanthropy. All my life, I've had fantastic success. I don't have to prove myself, she adds. The truth will prevail. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.